Welcome to Local Talk Wednesday on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Welcome to our hosts, Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson.
Thanks, Mike, and to you listeners who are joining us today. You are just in time to hear Leanne Harder back with us for the Story County Report, and Paul Wearson is here to greet her. I'll turn the program over to Paul and Leanne to get us started.
Well, hello, Leanne, and thank you very much. I got my taxes paid on time, thanks to your reminder. So I haven't seen the sheriff, and I'm still matriculating here on the farm, thanks to you and your timely reminder last month. So we're all waiting with bated breath to hear what you have to say about what's coming up now.
Well, thank you, Paul. Good morning, and I'm glad to hear you're safe and sound at home and no need to come bail you out from anywhere. I want to just start with a call for all photographers out there, whether you're amateur or professional, and you're out and about in Story County, and you see photos that really speak about what Story County is to you, or if you have a favorite place in Story County. We have a social media presence that we're sharing every week, a photo of the week. So we're open to taking people's photographs and sharing them out there. So send it to storycountyis85@gmail.com. You can be featured on our social media. So keep that in mind as you're out and about this fall with the gorgeous changing colors of the leaves. I want to switch now to passports. And are you in need of a passport, or do you even maybe need to renew yours? Do you know when you need to renew yours? Are you maybe thinking about an international trip with family or spring break next spring, 2022? Well, Story County reporter Stacy Herridge shares that turnaround time for passports is currently running at about 16 weeks. So if you're having those thoughts, you need a passport, you need to start applying for one. You can, for an additional charge of $60, get that down to 12-week expedited processing time. But still, that's, what, 3 months out. So start talking with Stacy Herridge in the county recorder's office at 515-382-7230. There's also more information on our website at www.storycountyiowa.gov. Now I want to give a shout out to the Supermarket 2021 for Veterans. That's going to be held at the Plex from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's next month, and it's the annual Supermarket Veterans Benefits with donuts and coffee provided, and then there's haircuts all day as well for veterans. It takes place, as I said, at the Plex at 5501 George Washington Carver Avenue in Ames. You can contact Brett McLean at 515-956-2626 for more information. Also, we have openings for boards and commissions in Story County. We're accepting applications for the ASSET, which is Analysis of Social Services Evaluation Team, the Board of Adjustment, the Board of Health, Conservation Board, and then a new one we've added is the Story County Judicial Magistrate Appointment Commission. You can send your questions about any of those commissions to Sandra King. She can be reached at sking@storycountyiowa.gov or by phoning 515-382-7200. The deadline to apply is through October 29th. So that's next Friday at 4:30 p.m. The application, if you're interested in applying, is on our website. And I'll say that again at the end of the show or end of my segment. But you can simply apply online and it submits itself right to Sandra. So again, keep in mind, Friday, October 29th, and applications are available on our website. And then we all know the upcoming city school election is upon us. Absentee voting in person is now happening in the auditor's office at 900 6th Street in Nevada. It started on October 13th and is available through Monday, November 5th. It's the in-person satellite voting is at Satellite voting in person is at other places other than the auditor's office. There are a couple locations for those as well. Friday, October 22nd at the Memorial Union, the Cardinal Room of the Iowa State campus, and then Saturday, October 30th at the Ames Public Library. Those satellite stations are open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. So again, Friday, October 22nd at the Memorial Union at Iowa State campus, and then Saturday, October 30th at Ames Public Library. If you did receive an absentee ballot by mail and you need to return it, you have some options. By mail, you can a return envelope is provided with prepaid postage. All ballots must be received in the auditor's office by the close of election day in order to be considered for counting. So make sure you account for that and get it in the mail as soon as you can to make sure it gets to Nevada. You can also bring your absentee ballot in person. You or a member of your household or immediate family may deliver your ballot to the auditor's office up until 8 p.m. on election day, which is, again, Tuesday, November 2nd. Completed ballots may not be dropped off or used at polling locations, so keep that in mind. And then lastly, you can use a delivery agent for disabled voters only. They may designate someone else to mail or deliver the voted ballot. Those instructions are included in the mailed absentee ballot packet. It also includes a receipt if you choose to designate a delivery agent. So if you want to vote in person, you can go to the county auditor's office through Monday, November 1st. When you have directions to return your absentee ballot. And then lastly, remember, you can vote at your polling location on Tuesday, November 2nd. I want to just quickly remind everyone to take some time and sign up for Story County, Iowa alerts. Registering online allows you to create a profile for yourself and family in one place. If you have family members or loved ones in other Story County communities, so say you work in Ames and live in Ames, but your children, your adult children live in Cambridge, you can keep the notices going for them as well. You can add their address information to your profile to be aware of any disasters or emergencies affecting them as well. You can go to storycountyiowa.gov and you can find the link, or go to, and I think you have this on your website too, or did at one time, www.smart911.com. And then it continues on and, with smart911.com/REF/, and then eventually get to Story County, Iowa. So the directions are online, which is the easiest, where you can shoot me an email and I can get you some information. Just a reminder, since August, the Story County Board of Supervisors reinstated the face covering requirement for all visitors to county buildings over the age of 2, regardless of vaccination status. Unless an individual has a disability that prevents them from wearing a face covering, we have disposable face coverings available for the public at each county building, and we remain open to walk-in traffic. Residents and businesses may also conduct county business online, by phone, by email, by mail. There's drop boxes, lots of different ways. So again, a reminder that all visitors must wear masks in county buildings, in Story County buildings. And if you have any questions, please let us know at 515-382-7200. And last, how to reach us. Again, I say this every month, and we do get a few more people signing up for Notify Me, but Notify Me is a tool on our website that lets you sign up to get the different agendas, minutes, notices that go out, press releases, through our website directly. So go to storycountyiowa.gov, look for the Notify Me button, and sign up. And if you're on social media, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And then our YouTube channel has the Board of Supervisors meetings every week on a rebroadcast basis, and you can watch the quick video recaps that the Board of Supervisors are doing on a weekly basis. So if you do have any questions, you can contact me at lharder@storycountyiowa.gov. My phone number is 515-382-7247. And in conclusion, our mission at Story County is to continue engaging our diverse communities to responsibly provide quality opportunities and services that matter. I thank everyone at KHOI for our ongoing partnership, and I love this opportunity to join you every month. And now, yeah, I am not kicking off the month anymore. I'm now kind of in the middle of the month. So I'm your hump day kickoff, I guess you can say. So that's what's happening at Story County.
Well, thank you, Leanne, especially your hints and reminders about voting procedures, because a lot of people are confused about that. And I think that changes have been made, and it's pretty nice to have chapter and verse about how to vote.
Yeah,
and I wish you a happy Halloween, and I hope you have a lot of people stopping by your door. I think everything's back to normal this year for trick-or-treat, isn't it? The kids can still walk by and knock on doors.
I think so. Yeah, now it's just a matter of making sure we get the candy to last till Halloween in our household.
Yes, well, I'm going, this year I'm going as a young man, so it'll take hours in the makeup chair.
Oh, Paul. I do recommend everyone go to our website if they have any questions about voting. As you said, the voting procedures have been changed, so there are new voting laws in effect, and our auditor, Lucy Martin, has it spelled out very clearly, and if you have any questions, they are available to help.
Well, thank you, Leanne. Have a good month, and we'll hear from you again now in November.
See you soon.
In case you just tuned in, this is Local Talk Community Radio, 89.1 FM, and host Paul Wearson has been talking with Leanne Harder, Story County Outreach and Special Projects Manager. Our somber selection of stories today begins with a discussion and readings from a local author, Kim Harms from Huxley. The title of her book is Life Reconstructed, Navigating the World of Mastectomies and Breast Construction. Here is Kim walking us through this difficult subject.
My name is Kim Harms, and I am the author of Life Reconstructed, Navigating the World of Mastectomies and Breast Reconstruction. That just came out a few weeks ago. I've been a writer for a lot of years. I was a newspaper reporter before I had kids, and then decided to stay home with my three boys and did that for a lot of years, and part-time freelance writing at that time. But this book is actually my first book that I've written.
And what caused you to write it?
Well, I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2016, so January of 2016. It was 1 month to the day after my 40th birthday. And I had bilateral mastectomy, so a double mastectomy and breast reconstruction. And there's a lot to those surgeries and decisions that need to be made and treatment and options. And as I was going through that, there were a lot of things that I thought, oh, I wish I would have known this at the outset. And I wish I would have known this and that. And I actually sat down at my kitchen table that summer in between surgeries and thought about the things that I had wanted to know, and within about a half hour came up with about 11 chapter titles and a paragraph synopsis on each one of those of where I wanted to go with that chapter. And I thought, I'm going to do this. I'm going to write this book. And that came very easy to me that day. But after that, it's been quite a process. So from that idea to actually coming out was a 5-year process. So it's been kind of a long road, and it wasn't all as easy as the idea, but worthwhile. And I actually learned a lot as I went through it. And I interviewed many women and some medical professionals, and I feel like it's ended up being a good resource, hopefully, for women who are going through the same thing that I've gone through.
When I first saw the book, I thought, that's what it would be a resource. I have known women who had breast cancer, but I didn't even realize what their options were, much less the details of what they were going through. And So for somebody who's outside of this, a friend, maybe not even a very supportive friend, this is a real eye-opener and a really valuable book because I understood so much more about my friend.
I'm glad to hear that. That's really my hope with this book, to help the women going through it. But also, I really do think that the people who are friends and family who are watching her go through it, it just would help them to have a better understanding of, you know, what life is like and the challenges of specifically breast cancer surgeries, because that's really what the book focuses on, is the mastectomies and the breast reconstruction.
Well, there's several passages that I thought were so charming. And I know you just recently have been doing some book readings. So I'd like you to pick out your favorites.
Yeah, sure. I would like to read a section from chapter 9, which is actually a chapter that's from a male perspective. Well, it's written based on interviews that I did with spouses of people going through breast cancer. So I kind of have the man's perspective in that chapter and just wanted to think about what is this like for husbands going through it and to give them some information. So yeah, I'll read the start of that chapter, and it's chapter 9, and it's called "This is Hard for Him Too, A Husband's Perspective." And it starts, "A photo hangs in our house of Corey standing at the top of the world, arms outstretched and a big smile on his face. The sign he's standing beside reads, Mount Kilimanjaro, congratulations, you are now at Uhuru Peak, Tanzania, 19,341 feet. It was taken in August of 2017, a year and a half after I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I love that picture. I tend to be a pretty frugal person, and a hike to the top of Africa's tallest mountain is not an inexpensive endeavor, but I believe it was worth every penny. I also believe that, in a way, it was a gift. Though Corey enjoys climbing mountains in the United States, he never would have thought out a trip this indulgent on his own, but it presented itself to him at the right moment. Multiple times as he considered the trip, he said, I shouldn't go, it's too much money, but I pushed him toward it. He took amazing care of me during my cancer year, giving up a lot for my sake. And I thought a couple weeks climbing a mountain with some buddies might give him a chance to unwind and process what he'd gone through, what we'd gone through together. The mountain climbing money could have been a new kitchen, but the picture of my man on top of the mountain is infinitely more valuable than stainless steel appliances and granite countertops. Your husband probably didn't climb Mount Kilimanjaro after you reached the other shift treatment. You may not even have a husband or significant other, in which case you can probably skip ahead to the next chapter. But chances are your man needs or needed some way to decompress after it was over. So the cancer is oh so hard on us, the women whose body it invaded. It also takes a toll on the men who love us. The afternoon I received my diagnosis, I remember Corey crying and saying, I wish I could take this for you. Why can't it be me instead? It's heart-wrenching for our husbands to watch us go through painful things. For a lot of guys, there's a feeling of utter helplessness. And because most guys are wired to fix things, being helpless is a very tough spot for them. As protectors and comforters, our men long to take our pain away. But cancer and the physical and emotional pain it causes is something they can't fix. So if your husband behaves in a way that is frustrating to you, it might be because he isn't sure how to handle a problem he can't fix. Studies show that male brains are often wired to be emotional fixers in relationships. In an article at today.com, author of The Male Brain, a neuropsychiatrist, Dr. Joanne Brizendine, explores the differences between male and female brains that help explain why some men act the way they do. She says, it's very much men wanting to fix it when he's feeling an uncomfortable emotion. So these things can really cause conflicts in relationships because she feels she's not heard by him and thinks he's just running her over. Because he's wired to fix things, your man's support might rub you the wrong way sometimes, but chances are he's in no way trying to hurt you. He's simply working through this diagnosis in the best way he knows how. In his book, Breast Cancer Husband, Mark Silver says, our wives want to tell us how they're feeling. We may feel uncomfortable listening. Part of the reason we maybe our male desire to fix things. And how do you fix a bad feeling? By making it go away, of course, by changing the subject, by avoiding the topic, by trying to convince your wife to cheer up. Silver's words may resonate with your experience. Maybe your husband changes the subject when he doesn't know what to do with it. Maybe he avoids talking cancer altogether. Or maybe you find he is continually trying to cheer you up, even when what you need most is a good cry on his shoulder. So that's the first part of my chapter on the husband's side of things. I actually have a chapter that is devoted to children as well, or to parenting through breast cancer, because, you know, our kids are an important part of this too. Don't forget to include your kids. They may or may not ask questions, but they have them. And it starts out, "Did you have your appointment today? It was the evening of biopsy day, and I was driving Carter home from basketball practice. My oldest is a man of few words, just like his daddy. He doesn't ask a lot of questions, and he rarely offers his heart. So when words come out of his mouth, I listen. I knew those words were a big deal. Underneath that question was a deeper question I know he couldn't bring himself to ask. Do you have cancer? More than anything, I wanted to ease his worry. I wanted to say everything's A-okay. I just had a simple procedure, and I'm all clear. But I didn't know, and I didn't want to give him false hope. I had the biopsy, it went smoothly, and I'm feeling okay, but we don't have any results yet. It was the best I could do. The next day, it was affirmed that cancer had indeed invaded my left breast. I could answer Carter's question now, but how? How does a mom do that? What's the best way to break your child's heart? Over ice cream after supper? During a commercial break in the NBA game? In the quiet of his room at bedtime? Ugh. There is no good time to tell your kids you have cancer. Corey and I decided it would be best to call a family meeting, the one I described at the introduction of this book. Looking back, I still think that this was the best way to bring our kids into our new cancer world, but it wasn't easy. Your family is no doubt different from mine, and you have to do things in the way that works best for you. Maybe that's telling your kids one-on-one. Maybe it's over dinner. Maybe it's at a family meeting like us. I can't answer that for you, but I do believe there are some thoughts that all parents should consider while traveling this crappy road. To shelter or to share with your kids. My mama instinct is to protect my kids. I'm sure yours is too. But sometimes protecting them is not an option, and sometimes sheltering our children from the hurt isn't the right answer, even if it is an option. When hard things smack us from behind and knock the wind out of us, the best answer is not always to figure out how to shield our kids from pain, but instead to decipher how to help them walk through the pain with us. Our January 21st family meeting was awful. It was heartbreaking. It was a conversation no parent ever wants to have with their children, but it was necessary, and it was the beginning of growth in my boys that would have not happened without cancer. We never would have chosen it, of course, but I see all three of my boys on the other side of cancer stronger and more compassionate than ever before." So that is the first couple pages of my chapter devoted to how to walk this road with your kids.
One of the other things that really impressed me with the book was the way you dealt with your faith, which was very, very important. But what you said and how someone who doesn't share your faith could find comfort and a way in that.
Yes. Yeah, I can't tell my story without sharing my faith because it's just such a big part of who I am. So I knew going into this book that when I was sharing the pieces of the story that were about me and my process and my experience, I had to share my faith in God. But I also wanted to write this book for any woman, because it's not just women of faith who get breast cancer. So I wanted to be able to have people read this and be encouraged by my experience and see how that faith worked in my life, but also not to make them feel uncomfortable or that I'm trying to push my faith on them, because that's not what this book is about. And the book has my faith in it, because my story would just not be fully told without it. But it's not the focus of the book, I guess. But one of the things I write about in the intro, just an example of just how faith works through this, is there's a verse, Isaiah 41:10, that says, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I'll strengthen you, and I will help you, and I will uphold you with my right hand of righteousness." And it's funny, I memorized that verse when I was in high school and in track, and I hated waiting for the gun to go off. And so I would be on the track, and I would just repeat that over and over in my head, that verse, to calm my nerves. And then, you know, fast forward, and I'm 40 years old. I find a lump in my breast. My doctor says, "Yeah, this might be cancer. We need to have it checked out." And I'm just so scared at that point. And I wake up at night, every night, I wake up multiple times, just scared with my heart racing. And I repeat that verse over and over to calm me down, just like I did when I was in high school. And what happened was that verse kept coming at me from different places. I got a card sent to me from one of my friend's grandmas who had that verse in it. So some of my friends on Facebook gave me that verse. It just kept coming up. But the most memorable one was Corey and I were sitting in the waiting room waiting to go in for my biopsy, and they called my name. And I stood up, and the minute I stood up, my phone pinged, and I looked at it, and it was a text from my friend Wendy, and it was just the words of that verse. That's all that text was, and it just made me feel like, okay, I don't know what my future holds, but God is here, and He is showing me that in this text. So that's just an example of how that worked in my life and how important that was to me and how it helped me through this. So I hope as people read it, they see that and are encouraged by that.
Thank you so much.
This is Local Talk on KHOI 89.1 FM, where you have been listening to local author Kim Harms sharing her discoveries and guidance for those who are facing a diagnosis of breast cancer for themselves or loved ones. Taking a break from COVID-19, we'll be talking about two dread diseases that have been successfully eliminated from the earth. For that, we have as our guest Professor Alan Marcus, who was a distinguished humanities professor at Iowa State University when he left in 2005 to become head of the history department at Mississippi State University. He is also the author of works focusing on the history of technology, science, medicine, intellectual history, and the history of agriculture. Sounds like a good person to know when you're looking for guests on KHOI. Welcome, Professor Marcus. Thank you for bringing your broad knowledge to one of the most devastating diseases in modern history. My first question is, what does it mean when a disease is eradicated?
Well, that eradication means that there are at present no more identifiable pockets or indications of smallpox. In fact, when they had the last few, they put armed guards outside of the various houses so that no one could come in or out, or that person could not spread the disease elsewhere. So that was last done in 78, and after not having any cases of smallpox between 78 and 80, they declared it eradicated.
But they have kept some somewhere so that they could make a vaccine if they needed to.
Some people say that. We say when the Soviet Union did it, they were going to make a biological weapon. So it could be either way. Once it exists, it has the ability to be mutated, to be changed, to be used for good, to be used for evil. And given the fact that all this happened during the Cold War, there's a lot of suspicion on both sides. The interesting thing I was going to say about smallpox eradication, or the whole movement for smallpox eradication, first came in the 50s out of the Soviet Union rather than the United States. The Soviet Union was first actively involved, and in part because the Cold War was a battle for the hearts and minds of unaffiliated countries. We used to call third world and fourth world countries. And the United States and the Soviet Union spent much of their efforts and time trying to woo those countries over to their side, whether communist or democratic. And the Soviet Union started in about 51, pushing for the whole idea of eradicating smallpox. In the World Health Conference, which took place in the later 50s, it agreed that the whole idea is we should, through vaccination and through vaccinators, we could wipe out smallpox in a reasonable time. Most of the smallpox at that time was not in United States or in Europe, but it was in Africa and in Asia. But there was no money put forward to that. The Soviet Union didn't pay for it. We didn't pay for it. So nothing happened. Later, the World Health Organization, this was an offshoot of the United Nations, decided to take up the mantle and go for smallpox eradication. And in that case, the United States funded virtually the entire effort. The United States, although belatedly, got behind the whole effort and funded almost all the eradication that was done in Asia and Africa. So that by 78, there were no more cases identified, and by 80, they declared it eradicated.
The new world is that there was no defense against it because there weren't any people who had gotten it until outsiders brought it in, and it didn't take more than one or two to destroy a country. Now, is that just exaggeration, or is that really what happened?
Well, it takes a lot longer than that. I mean, you can take one or two and affect a bunch of other people, but if those people that are infected are not isolated, then where you had two persons bringing it in, you soon have 10 people, and when you have 10 people going home to their families and their tribes and other things, pretty soon you have 40 people. When you have 40 people, things get out of hand. That's the problem with any epidemic or pandemic, is that it starts slowly and it just spreads, because every time you give it to another person, there's a whole another population that could be attracted to it. And in a place where there was no frequency or no familiarity with smallpox, spread was rapid, quick, and very fatal.
So in North America, which is what I've heard that millions died, and most of those millions were the population. But you had a little bit different story about, I guess, the Europeans who came already knew about some kind of, now there's a difference between inoculation and vaccination.
Correct. But the whole inoculation movement, even in Europe, doesn't occur till the 17th century. And the period when the Spanish came to the New World was before then. So this coming to the New World and infecting people in late 17th century, there was no inoculation to be had. But first in, roughly at the same time, but first in the Royal Crown of England, a Lady Mary Montagu noted from talking to her when she was, her husband was ambassador to what is now Turkey, Istanbul then, noticed that there was a practice called buying the disease. And that meant you found someone who had the disease, you took their scab, you made a cut in your arm, and you pushed the scab on that cut. That would invariably give you the disease, but the disease that it would give you was generally, not exclusively, but generally less severe than if you got it naturally. So that statistics ultimately found that about 2% of the people who are inoculated, and inoculated means getting the real virulent disease, smallpox, about 2% died, while as many as 30% would die if they got it naturally. Now, those statistics were not known at that time, but she eyeballed the situation and gave it to her family, tried to have King George of England inoculate his whole family and the whole court. He did inoculate his granddaughters, but he wouldn't inoculate his grandsons because he wanted to make sure they stayed alive and kept the line going. And that happened in about 1715 to 1720. At the same time, roughly, there was a big outbreak of smallpox in America. And as in Turkey, some parts of Africa believed in inoculation, buying the disease, getting a scab, cutting it, and giving it from person to person. And it turns out that one of the slaves who knew this worked with the Puritan divine, the leader of the Puritan church, basically, Cotton Mather. Now, Cotton Mather was an interesting guy. He was very involved in the Royal Society in London, but he was also very involved in the Salem witch trials, where 14 women and 6 men were executed for being witches. But when Mather saw about the process of inoculation, about buying the disease, he immediately saw its benefits to Boston generally and to Massachusetts Bay more particularly. And he had his family inoculated with the disease. Almost all the physicians of Boston were opposed to this practice. They thought in many ways it was the work of the devil. You were violating God's law. God's law gave you the disease and you recovered from the disease or didn't recover from the disease. That was God's will. What Mather is doing, he's giving people the disease by inoculating them and therefore violating God's will. So much so that his house was firebombed. The bomb didn't go off, but his house burned to the ground. They accused him of being irreligious. But statistics showed at the end, and he had one physician, a guy named Boylston, who worked with him, that the chances of getting the disease that way led to a more successful recovery than if you got it naturally. The problem, of course, with inoculation is the same problem you had in America in the 16th century, which is once you give someone the disease and they're walking around, they can spread it to other people. So in a sense, while inoculating people in Boston and saving the people that he worked with, he was causing an epidemic for the rest of the city. Let's move a little bit to a vaccination, which is a better story. Well, unless you want to talk about Washington and his forces. In 1777, Washington wanted to go attack a particular place, but his troops that he had with him were all sick with smallpox. We couldn't do it. So he resolved at that point to inoculate them with the disease so that all of Washington's troops after that point had to be inoculated. 2% of them statistically died, but the rest of them were immune and could fight and not have to worry about contracting the disease. Turns out that the English did the same thing with their troops. So pretty much during the Revolution, after 1777, both the English and the Americans both had inoculated troops. But inoculation does, again, what I said it did before. You take it, and all of a sudden, by definition, you go through a town, you go through a countryside, you're spreading the disease wherever you go, because it's live, real smallpox. What happened a little later, which is about 1796, was that an English physician, a prominent English physician, worked with the Hunter brothers, who were the leading lights at the time, noticed that milkmaids, young women who worked milking cows, had really, really fine skin. Smallpox skin is hideous. You got pustules and bumps and scars, and it's not an attractive disease once you contact it. But all the young women, the milkmaids, all had beautiful skin. And he did some investigating and did some talking with the milkmaids. And this man, Edward Jenner, found out that they seemed not to get smallpox because they got something called cowpox. Cowpox also was a live disease, but it was a much milder disease than smallpox. And he found out that through the milkmaids and their pristine skin that they were not going to get smallpox because they were protected by cowpox. The Latin word for cow is vaccina. Hence, he would give cowpox vaccina to everybody who he'd come in contact with. And first they used 6 prisoners from Newgate Prison, and they all couldn't get smallpox. They were inoculated with smallpox soon after getting their cowpox. And then 11 orphans from England were inoculated. We were given the cowpox and then inoculated with smallpox. And they didn't get the disease. And pretty soon thereafter, within 10 years, I think 12 European countries were all vaccinating against smallpox. So by 1810 or so, you had a pretty significant part of Europe using cowpox to prevent from getting smallpox. And cowpox, if it spread, it was a pretty uneventful, nothing disease. It wasn't like smallpox where you'd inoculate and you'd cause a plague.
Sounds amazing.
Well, it is amazing, and a lot of it's observation, and a lot of it's seizing on seeing something and then figuring where it would go and what it might be used for. You know, cowpox has been around for a long time before someone decided it might be used or useful against smallpox. So it takes not just simply the event, but also recognizing for what the event could be used for. No vaccine is 100% effective, but given the fact that very, very, very few people took sick from cowpox and fewer died, and you might have 30% of the population dying from smallpox in some places, it was obvious very quickly. So there wasn't much resistance right away. In fact, the resistance was very little right away. Well, no one gets vaccinated anymore for smallpox. The whole point of eradicating it and keeping the little vial is we don't think there's going to be any more smallpox ever. But if there is, we've got to make the vaccine right away.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and we've just heard from Alan Marcus, Distinguished Professor and Chair of the Department of History at Mississippi State University, introducing us to the history of the eradication of smallpox. It's appropriate for KHOI to follow the story of the eradication of smallpox by closing the show on World Polio Day with Susan Herrick from Boone, who played a significant role in the work to eliminate polio, a disease that our older listeners can remember as it crippled friends of ours and made every summer a time of terror. And we now have with us Susan Herrick from Boone, who will take us to the story of World Polio Day. Is that right? This is it.
That's correct. Thanks, Susan. World Polio Day really will be Sunday, October the 24th, and it's 24th every year, so it can be any day, but it's certainly a day that we use to highlight polio and correct some things that people believe about polio that are not true, and a whole lot of things that we need to educate people about the things that are true. First of all, Susan, you had said that polio has been eradicated. It has not. Certainly here in the United States, it has been since the late 1900s, but it's certainly here still. And we're still working every day as Rotary International to eradicate polio from the planet. When I joined Rotary back in 1993, there were four countries that were endemic for polio: India, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Since that time, Pakistan and Afghanistan are the only two countries that are endemic. And we were surprised the next one that eradicated polio was India, because we weren't sure we could reach all the children in India because of the vast population. But the people of India worked with Rotary International and other entities and got it done. So then it was just Nigeria and Pakistan, Afghanistan. And Nigeria, at one point, we thought we had it. In order to say a disease is eradicated, it has to be gone for 3 years. No traces of it whatsoever. And we had seen 3 years in Nigeria with no polio. So they declared it eradicated. And then the following year, 25 cases popped up. So we had to start over again, but we made it again through 3 years. And so once again, Nigeria is without polio. But we still have it in those two countries. And when you say Pakistan and Afghanistan, you know those are not easy countries to work with or get into. but there are Rotarians in both of those countries, and they're working very hard. See, back in 2017, there were only 22 cases worldwide of the wild poliovirus. And so we thought we were so close. But then the next year it was 33, and the year after that was 176. So it kept growing and growing. But now, this year, there have only been two cases of polio in the world, one in Afghanistan, one in Pakistan. And those were back in January. So we're holding our breath and monitoring water systems and everything to see if polio is, the virus is showing up anywhere. We're not seeing it. So we think maybe this is accurate. And if we can go now for 3 years without finding another case, then we can say to the world, we've done it. We have eradicated polio from this planet, which is what we promised the children of the world back in 1985, when there were 350,000 cases of polio a year. And that was in 122 countries and territories. And there were three strains of the wild polio virus. There is now one strain only. So we were able to find a vaccine just for that one type. We didn't have to use a trivalent type anymore. So it was more targeted toward this kind of polio. We're getting there. We are so, so close. And we think we have saved about 20 million children from the paralysis or death of polio. That's pretty exciting. And we have a lot of great partners in this, WHO, CDC, UNICEF. But our greatest partner is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. For every dollar that Rotary raises, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation matches it with $2. So if somebody gives $30, that's really $90 because it's matched by the Gates Foundation. Interestingly enough, Bill Gates's mother had polio. And that, of course, was the beginning of his move into trying to help out with polio eradication. But it's gone way beyond that now. Of course, he's been overseas and met with people who are working to fight polio and also to meet the children who've been affected by polio. So he's 100% our partner in this, and we're very grateful for that. In 2006, I was fortunate enough and blessed enough to get to go to Niger, Africa, to help with their national immunization days. At that point, it had been eradicated from Niger, but again, you have to keep vaccinating those children, giving them those precious drops for at least how many ever years it takes to eradicate the disease, because it can come back at any point. So people need to keep vaccinating their kids against polio. And that goes for us in this country too. Polio is really only a plane ride away. Every once in a while, we see a case pop up in New York State or any other place where people are coming in from overseas, and a child will come in with a high fever, and most doctors are too young really to even remember what polio looks like. And so it takes a senior doctor usually to spot it first and say, yes, this is polio. There's no cure for polio, but we certainly have ways to treat it. And because there's no cure, we have to keep vaccinating until it's gone, until it disappears from the earth. And polio mainly affects children under the age of 5. They used to call it infantile paralysis. And so that vaccine is so important to keep those children safe. We've reduced 99.9% of it. You know, we say we're this close and hold our fingers almost close together as we can get them to say we're this close to eradicating it. But until it's gone forever, every child is at risk to come down with polio. And we can remember, some of us who are older, senior members can remember that when polio was in town and when they closed our swimming pools and they shut down big group meetings because they didn't know what caused polio. So they weren't sure. They thought maybe it was hooked to water. They didn't know. But they really worked to make sure that people weren't exposed to polio. Now, of course, we know that it's a virus and that we do have a way to prevent it from happening. But that's a knowledge that we need to keep before people's minds so that they understand that you need to keep vaccinating against polio because it is a virus that is still in the world. There are still some vaccine-derived cases that are popping up around the world because some of the older vaccines use a live polio virus in them. We are slowly getting that out of the system and think that by the end of this year, we'll have that live polio virus completely out of the system so that we will not have any more of the vaccine-derived polio cases. But sometimes people will say to me, well, there are only two cases, but I heard there were cases in places you said it was eradicated. Well, that would be the vaccine-derived polio, and that will be gone as soon as the live poliovirus vaccines are gone. So we are so close. We are so excited that we're getting there fast. And now, sadly, people who had polio as youngsters and are now middle-aged or older are being stricken with something called post-polio syndrome, which means if you had polio as a child, it may come back in some way on your body as you get older. So the post-polio syndrome is something that our Polio Plus group continues to work on, too, to make sure that we're giving help to those people. But Rotary International has pledged to raise at least $50 million a year to continue this fight, to develop vaccines, to travel people to where they need to go to help fight the disease. But again, that's matched by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So that's $150 million a year that Rotary International is generating to take care of this. So as we approach World Polio Day on Sunday, I hope you continue to hear education pieces about polio so that we all understand that we need to keep donating to this cause. We sure don't want it to come back. And the possibility of coming back is always there until it's gone. So when we say, oh, there have only been two cases a year, well, we don't have to worry about that anymore. Yeah, we do. We still are worried about it every day and making sure that we're there to help out. You know, when we talk about what's happened with polio over the years, and now we look at our current disease of COVID, there are a lot of things that the polio experience has taught us that we've been able to help with the COVID-19 people that are trying to tackle that disease. We've handed over all of our research about when and where to find it and when and where to be able to vaccinate against it. So what we've learned from our work with polio certainly helps. And when Ebola struck, we were able to go in and help them too with information about how to go about fighting that disease. I know I've talked a lot, Susan. Do you have any questions?
No, I don't think we have time for questions. Thank you very, very much. I guess the big thing is that you still need polio shots.
You still do.
I remember when they were first possible, and there was nobody who was refusing them.
That's right.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We've been your hosts for today, Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson. Other voices you heard were Leanne Harter, Kim Harms, Alan Marcus, and Susan Herrick. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at 7 p.m. Local Talk was engineered by Michael Murphy. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio. Thank you.
Making contact.
This week on Making Contact, we look at the criminal justice system when Black women are leading the way on policy and reform.
We heard from hundreds of people saying, help us. Help us. This is what happened to me. This is what happened to my son. We've seen people talk about being wrongly incarcerated for years. I mean, we've seen that. And to sit here and act like anything near the status quo is acceptable hurts. I'm going to stop covering up my pain.
Again, that's this week on Making Contact.
Thursday at 1:30, right after Sprouts.